VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Eddie Urema. He's senior editor in VOA's Central Africa Service. Our topic, African hotspots. Our guest, Dr. Joseph Siegel. He's director of the Africa Center's research program at the National Defense University here in Washington. Joseph Siegel's research focuses on the relationship between governance, security, and development, stabilization of fragile states, democratic transitions, and strengthening institutions of accountability. Prior to joining the Africa Center at NDU, he was a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He also previously served in various field capacities in Africa, Asia, and the Balkans with the international NGO World Vision, and he was a Peace Corps volunteer. We'll be analyzing a number of current African hotspots with Joseph Siegel, including the controversial election results in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the deadly attack in Kenya by al-Shabaab, the popular uprising in Sudan against the 30-year rule of Omar al-Bashir, and the Zimbabwean government's deadly crackdown on fuel hike protesters. And Joseph Siegel joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome back my colleague, Eddie Urema. He's our senior editor in VOA's Central Africa Service.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Well, Joseph, let's start first with the disputed December 30th election results in the Democratic Republic of Congo that featured widespread irregularities, disenfranchisement even, and evidence of manipulation. Nonetheless, the nation's highest court certified the opposition candidate, Felix Tshisekedi, that he won, notwithstanding leaked data from a whistleblower on the Electoral Commission that shows runner-up Martin Fayulu probably should have won. How do you see this, notwithstanding, you know, the official results? How do you see this going forward? Is this a step in the right direction, or does the cloud over these disputed results portend a further instability?
Well, I really expect the way this is playing out to lead to chronic instability in the Democratic Republic of Congo. These elections were a real opportunity for change and for reform. You had widespread popular support for the two leading opposition candidates, Martin Fayulu and Felix Tshisekedi. People were mobilized on the streets. You had independent monitors, particularly the Catholic Church, out at 40,000 polling stations. And people turned out, and they voted for opposition candidates. And so it was a real opportunity to turn the page on what has been decades-long misgovernance and corruption and underdevelopment in DRC. And indeed, when the results from the independent monitors were coming in, it seemed clear that the ruling party candidate, Shadari, had lost badly. And there was pressure from regional actors, the AU, the Southern African Development Community, the Central African Governing Coalition. You know, they had all made pronouncements saying Joseph Kabila should accept the results. And so there was momentum for real transparency. Unfortunately, Kabila is a master manipulator, and he has, again, divided the opposition by playing one candidate against the other. And so we don't know all the details, of course, but it appears that he struck some sort of deal with Felix Tshisekedi, that Tshisekedi would be identified as the winner and he would take on the presidency. It should be noted that the government and Electoral Commission has also claimed that the ruling party swept the parliamentary elections. So this is important because it's the parliamentarians who are going to elect the prime minister. And so this means that Kabila's party will remain in control of most of the major ministries, including security and mining. And so Tshisekedi is going to be, even if he's going into this with the right intentions, is going to be really limited and crippled in what he can do.
Joe, reports that we're getting right now is that Martin Fayulu maintains that he's the sole legitimate president of the DRC, though we've seen the AU, European Union, after first doubting the elections, now they're saying they're okay with Tshisekedi. How do you see this playing out?
Well, it's really unfortunate because whereas the regional actors and neighboring leaders had, I thought, taken some very principled positions about calling for transparency and realizing this was going to be in the best interest of the DRC and helping it to move off of this trajectory of instability that it's on, when push came to shove, they weren't willing to call Kabila out. You know, so when he pushed forward and had his appointees on the Constitutional Court, are the ones who ruled in his favor, basically, they weren't willing to push back and say, no, we need a recount. You know, this just doesn't add up. And so basically, it puts Fayulu in a very difficult position. But I think it really stains the reputation of the AU and of SADC and of other African leaders who are going along with this. You know, they know this isn't the real outcome, but for political reasons, they're just buying off on it.
Or do you think some people are saying, look, notwithstanding these disputes and claims of fraud, that really the peaceful transition of power, that still outweighs these shortcomings? In other words, we need stability. It's the first peaceful transition of power, and that should outweigh those concerns. And we have reports that Congolese voters are hungry for peace. They're ready to welcome Felix Tshisekedi, even if there was alleged election rigging involved in his victory.
It is not a small thing that an opposition party wins an election in a place that hasn't had a history of democratic change, to be sure. And let's recognize that Felix Tshisekedi comes from the longest opposition party in DRC. His father was a champion for change. Unfortunately, democratic change doesn't happen with just an election. You know, you need to change the institutions that underlie how a country is governed, and that foster accountability and checks and balances, and to make sure that government agencies are responsive to the general population. And that doesn't happen unless you have control of those institutions. And what's happening here is we have a figment of democracy with Tshisekedi coming in, but really, from best we can tell, all of the levers of power will continue to be controlled by Kabila, who will remain head of the ruling party. And he has already said that, you know, he is open to vying again for the political leadership in 4 years, the next election. I'm afraid we may not see very significant change even with this ostensible opposition victory.
What would you say to those who suggest that had Martin Fayulu not aligned with the likes of Moise Katumbi and Bemba, things would have been different?
Well, I think that certainly there's some truth to that. His alliances with these leading opposition leaders were very threatening to Kabila, and he wants to maintain as much control as he can. And so an alliance with those heavyweights and with people with that sort of popular support would make it more difficult for him to continue to pull the strings from behind the scenes. So I think it is one of the reasons that he probably reached out to Tshisekedi.
Again, today we received a statement from the State Department saying that the U.S. government welcomes the Congolese Constitutional Court certification of Felix Tshisekedi. Isn't it so early for the U.S. government to be approving of this?
Again, I think the U.S., as well as the EU and the African Union and SADC, had all initially expressed their skepticism at the provisional electoral results. And indeed, they had evidence both from the Catholic Church monitors as well as the leaked results from the Congolese Election Commission that showed that Fayulu had won. Unfortunately, I think international actors, the EU and the United States, felt much more constrained in what they could say or do once the African leaders in the region backed the Kabila results, basically. And so I think it becomes very difficult if you don't have regional support to try to push for that change from the outside. So I'm guessing that the U.S. State Department is trying to be as diplomatic about this as they can.
And quickly, before we go to a break, how do you think Martin Fayulu will proceed henceforth, since his request for a recount was rejected and his accusations that this was an electoral coup are now falling on fewer and fewer ears? How will he and his supporters go forward? Do you think they will just simply resign themselves to this reality, or could they cause more problems? And then there's also the East, the conflict. So there's so many challenges ahead for Tshisekedi and the new government.
There are a lot of challenges. I think what Fayulu does next will be very interesting. I think he may decide to call for a protest across the country. And indeed, he commands what we think was upwards of 60% of the popular vote. So there are a lot of supporters who might follow that call. But I think just a day of protest isn't going to change the complexion of this. It would have to be something that's sustained. And his political coalition is relatively new. It isn't as organized. It isn't as developed across the country. And so it's an open question whether they'd be able to sustain that pressure. And this has been one of the problems in the DRC for years, is the opposition, while they have regularly been outmaneuvered at election time, they haven't been able to maintain that organization on the ground. Their institutions aren't as strong. And so I think he's in a difficult place. To his credit and to the credit of the opposition historically in the DRC, they haven't resorted to violence. They have maintained a peaceful opposition approach. And I think it keeps DRC in a position where they could have a democratic transition that wouldn't be too polarized. You know, once a country turns into conflict, it's very difficult then for an opposition to come in and at least have some sort of support from the outgoing ruling leadership.
On the other hand, he doesn't have many seats in the parliament to fight within the context of the institution.
That's correct. Institutionally, Kabila will continue to hold most of the cards, and so he won't be able to work within the institutions. His protests are going to have to come from outside.
And in addition, the popularity of Tshisekedi in the capital, Kinshasa, also plays well for Kabila's game.
Well, you know, it's going to be interesting to me to see what Tshisekedi supporters say and do. And of course, there's a euphoria that their candidate is perceived to have won, but they are in some ways betraying, you know, a decades-long reform effort led by Etienne Tshisekedi, Felix's father. And they are really at risk of foregoing an opportunity for genuine change. And by foregoing that, it may be that Tshisekedi will never be part of that reform coalition. It will have to come from someplace else.
Do you both believe that Tshisekedi is really now in the pocket of Joseph Kabila, that he will not betray that alliance and maybe try to forge a different path?
I think the fact that the ruling coalition has the majority in parliament, that will keep Tshisekedi in check on behalf of Kabila.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to know what Tshisekedi's intentions are. I think he competed this election with earnest and sincerity, and you know, has great credentials as a reformer and calling for change. But in the best case scenario, he's very gullible about what he's signing on for. In worst case, he has made some sort of deal and he's going into this willingly. But I think it's a real uphill battle to expect that he's going to be able to lead any sort of significant reforms.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Joseph Siegel. He's director of the Africa Center's research program at the National Defense University here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with senior editor in VOA's Central Africa Service, Eddie Rema. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. And that's exactly what Taiwo Dada did. And here's a hearty shout out to his grandpa, a loyal listener from Lagos, Nigeria, Dr. Joseph Adelauye. So Taiwo, his grandson, sent us a message on Facebook telling us how much his grandpa enjoys the programs. His grandpa, Joseph Adelauye, earned a PhD from the University of Illinois in public health. He was also a WHO consultant and the author of many books. Thanks so much for listening, Joseph, and for your kind feedback through your grandson. If you want to hear your name on the air, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, and let's do sort of a lightning round, Joseph, if we want to get to all the other topics, Sudan, Kenya, and Zimbabwe. First, very briefly on Kenya, this terrible attack on the Dusit D2 hotel and office complex. This claimed the lives of at least 21 people, many other injured. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. What does this heinous attack on innocents say about the strength of Shabaab?
It means that Al-Shabaab remains resilient, and it has the ability to conduct these attacks, not only in Somalia, but periodically in Kenya. And increasingly, you know, it has its sights on Tanzania.
This is the third major threat since the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, and then the Westgate Mall in 2013. Why do you think Kenya is always a target?
The obvious reason is Kenya is part of the AMISOM peacekeeping coalition in Somalia, and it has put a lot of pressure on al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab has been displaced from all the main urban areas. It has lost a lot of leaders, and it wants to create some political cost for the Kenyan government and try to turn public opinion against that intervention.
Neighboring Uganda issued a warning saying that al-Shabaab might also be planning to attack the Ugandan government. Do you think al-Shabaab is trying to spread its terror to other countries within the East African region?
Not really, but there are some regional interests that it has. You know, al-Shabaab's strength has always been that it has some base of support within Somalia. And indeed, its whole reason of being is to try to create an Islamic state in Greater Somalia. And, you know, it should be noted that there are Somali populations in parts of Kenya, which it claims and would want to be part of this broader caliphate. But it really doesn't have the capability to threaten these neighboring states in any serious way. As we see, you know, when faced with a formidable fighting force in Somalia, it can't hold the territory there. But I condition it in that al-Shabaab is still trying to recruit and still trying to message into marginalized Muslim communities in Kenya and Tanzania. And so if they aren't able to directly mount any sort of sustained attack, they may be able to at least create more instability in these countries.
Is there anything more that the Kenyan government can do to combat the threat, whether it's addressing the concerns of these marginalized Muslim communities within Kenya or through other counterterrorism measures?
Well, I think in any sort of counterterrorism situation, you're in it for the long haul. And so what that means is there's a real premium on sustaining your effort and on trust. And it's important for the Kenyan security services to be reaching out into local communities, especially Muslim communities, so that it has a degree of trust and there can be a flow of information. They're aware of potential risk and that these communities believe that Kenyan police are on their side. And over the years, there has been a lot of tensions in that way, especially down at the coast. And so there's a lot of work for the Kenyan security services to do in that front. You know, I should add, most observers feel that the response here to the attacks at the Dusit D2 hotel were much more professional, much faster, and more under control than what we saw 5 years ago in Westgate.
Let's turn now to riots. Bread and fuel riots are sparking protests. First, the bread riots in Sudan, and then we'll get to the riots over rising fuel prices in Zimbabwe. But what about Sudan, Joe Siegel? What began as riots over the price of bread in December have morphed now into protests against the repressive regime of Omar al-Bashir, who finds himself in Qatar right now. He's tried to blame Darfuri rebels and other actors, but with very little success. How do you characterize this uprising? And could it succeed in getting Bashir to step down?
I would characterize it as a very serious threat to Bashir's time in power in Sudan. This explosion of outrage has just emerged in December, but it really is an outgrowth of years of misgovernance and economic mismanagement, corruption, a lack of investment in the economy and in infrastructure and education. And so the fact that we've seen this tripling of bread prices in Khartoum and in other parts of Sudan reflects just how weak the economy is and how frustrated so many Sudanese are. I think what's really important and different this time is that many in Bashir's governing coalition and the security services are also speaking out against him. And so he doesn't have the lockstep support that he has had in the past. And so there's some real clear handwriting on the wall saying that there are powerful interests against him.
Is he still wanted by the International Criminal Court?
Yes. it's a complicating factor, unfortunately, because he may be willing to leave because he doesn't like the outcomes of staying too long in Khartoum. But where does he go? And he would want protection from arrest to the ICC. He's going to have to look harder to find some place that's willing to not turn him over.
Is protesting the new norm of chasing or kicking out dictators in Africa these days?
Well, I don't know if we can say it's a norm yet, but protests have been growing in Africa and indeed around the rest of the world. And it's interesting because for a long time, protest was seen as sort of a Western political process. But over the last 5 years, maybe a little longer, we've seen a real upsurge in protest. And it's a way of people exerting their political rights. And I think it's part of a democratization culture that's taking hold in different places. And it's a way of expressing frustration or displeasure with the way things are going. Protests on their own, though, are not enough to displace, you know, leaders who have been in place for a long time. And so I think there has to be something more than protest to really lead to change. And nor do you want just every protest to lead to a political change.
But in a country that is not a democracy, that may be the only way, at least initially.
That's true. Absolutely. I think the people who are protesting are absolutely justified in this, and they don't have other avenues through which they can affect change.
And do you see Omar el-Bashir surviving this?
Well, I think it's still too early to say. I think it could still go in a number of couple of directions. But he does seem very weak right now. And again, there has been some crackdown on the part of the security services, but it hasn't been an all-out crackdown. And indeed, some of the intelligence services have come out and said that this crisis is a result of the government's mismanagement. You've seen some defections from the ruling party. And so there's, I think, some jockeying going around. I think there's just also some real fatigue with al-Bashir. And so he's been in power because of repression. And if he doesn't have that tool, then he's not going to last long.
Let's close now and talk about Zimbabwe. Joe Siegel, 6 months after presidential elections were held in Zimbabwe, that country finds itself in a very difficult and dangerous place. The euphoria that gripped the country after former President Robert Mugabe was ousted from power seems to be gone. The food shortages, skyrocketing fuel prices have triggered these mass protests, and they've been met with deadly force by Zimbabwe security forces, which have killed at least 12 people and wounded hundreds more. Now, President Emmerson Mnangagwa skipped the World Economics Forum, came back to try to attend to problems at home. But what really has changed? I mean, he seems to be implementing similar policies and the deadly tactics that his predecessor, Robert Mugabe, used. How do you see this country that tried to turn a chapter, but it doesn't seem to have done so?
Well, I think Zimbabwe is an example of a case where you can change a leader, but if you don't change the institutions, you have the same problems. And basically, Mnangagwa, despite how he may present himself, is a continuation of the Mugabe government under ZANU-PF, with, I would add, the strong support of the military. And so the military has taken a much more prominent role in government policy. And these policies, for years, have benefited ZANU-PF leaders. And that hasn't changed. And so there's been huge economic mismanagement and corruption. And when the elections were held and there were serious irregularities with those elections, many observers said at the time that without legitimacy, Mnangagwa was not going to be able to effect the real change that's needed to take Zimbabwe on a better course. And so I think the price hikes we're seeing, the rapid rise in inflation over the last several months, you know, these are all signs of the economic mismanagement that's been building for a long time in Zimbabwe. And so I think unless there's some fundamental political change, we're going to continue to see this crisis unfold.
Some are saying that these protests that are coming out of economic hardships that the population is going through in part is caused by the sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe. And we've had presidents like President of South Africa calling for the international community to lift these economic sanctions. Do you think this could help?
I don't think the source of the problem is the sanctions. As I said, this problem has been building for a long time. You'll remember Zimbabwe had exponential inflation a decade ago because of the mismanagement and, you know, the diversion of state resources into the pockets of party leaders. It was only when you had the power-sharing government and led by Finance Minister Tendai Biti that they were able to bring the economic turmoil under control. And, you know, they dropped the old currency, they pegged the New Zim dollar to the U.S. dollar, and that helped stabilize the economy. And with Tendai Biti in charge of the finance ministry. There was trust from the international community. People forget domestically there was trust and people's willingness to pay taxes increased. And so government revenues dramatically shot up. All this helped stabilize the economy. They were able to pay for basic services and salaries. And so that contributed to the stability that Zimbabwe enjoyed. Again, I think until you have, again, some sort of legitimate leadership and some real credible economic management, you're not going to see Zimbabwe regain its economic footing.
President Mnangagwa, on his arrival back to Zimbabwe, he called for a national dialogue. Do you think this is one way Zimbabwe can get rid of this crisis they're in right now?
I think it has to be more than a dialogue. I think they're going to have to really engage the opposition in governing. They're going to share power. And I think, you know, they, meaning ZANU-PF, but and I would include the military and actually, you know, current Vice President Constantino Chiwenga, you know, they are loath to do that. They push hard to get Mugabe out so they could control the political process. And they're very reluctant now to change course.
What about the Movement for Democratic Change, the opposition party? How willing would they be to engage in this so-called dialogue? They seem to be the target of the ire of the government and their supporters.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because, and I think it's an important part of the picture, you know, when the government has cracked down on the protest, it isn't that it's just that they've gotten protesters off the streets. They've gone after the MDC leaders and civil society leaders and union leaders. And so they're seeing it as a political opportunity to try to sideline the people that that they need to work with. That said, if you know Mnangagwa were to do an about face and say, "Listen, we're going about this the wrong way. We do need MDC and the government," I think they would be willing to engage. I think you know it's in their interest to prevent this economy from tanking, And right now, MDC is completely shut out of power. You know, I think they'd be very cautious. You know, MDC suffered a lot of political cost by their earlier power sharing with ZANU-PF because, you know, their constituents felt like they went into this agreement and they didn't really lead to real democratic change. So I think they would be very cautious about it, but I think they would be willing if they thought there was a serious offer.
And quickly before we close, is there a role for South Africa? Would they be willing to intervene in a positive way or, you know, talk to Mnangagwa and say, look, you know, you need to do this and we need to defuse this or any other actor or regional actor?
Well, South Africa is the right country to do something. And they always have a heavy influence in Zimbabwe. But... you know, they have allowed this to fester for a long time. First, it was because of respect for Robert Mugabe and his years as liberation leader. And now it's interesting because, you know, we've seen a change in South Africa with Cyril Ramaphosa taking the presidency. He has shown more of a commitment to regional governance issues and economic sobriety. You know, South Africa hosts hundreds of thousands, if not more than a million Zimbabweans in South Africa. So there's all sorts of incentives for South Africa to try to play a positive role. But they've been reluctant to do so. And even now, and I think for as much as for domestic political reasons, as much as anything, they're reluctant to push Mnangagwa for real change at this point in time. And so, you know, they'll talk about the need to lift sanctions, but they're not really, you know, pushing for the fundamental change to change some of the domestic policies within Zimbabwe.
Joseph Siegel is director of the research program at the Africa Center at the National Defense University right here in Washington. Joseph, thank you so much for your terrific insights on all these trouble spots.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington, and joining me on the program was senior editor in VOA's Central Africa service, Eddie Rema. And thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.